Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast. I am Reggie Darden, and I have with me, I'm really excited to have on my first Kenpo instructor, Mr. Pete Salas. I'm just, you know, overjoyed to get to talk to him, and, you know, we got to see each other, gosh, what was it, last year?
Yes.
I got to go and visit him and you know, just continue to see all the great things that he's doing. So I'm just, you know, really, really happy that you've agreed to be on, and we'll just kind of jump right in. Basically, and I'm actually kind of surprised that I don't know this, but I actually don't know your story of how you got involved in Kenpo and how you got started. So if you could just go ahead and fill me in, and we'll go from there.
Sure. I'll try to make it as brief as I can, because it's actually a very long story, but I think I can condense it.
Yeah, take all the time you want. Luckily, we have plenty of tape, so.
Okay. All right. Well, this is going to date myself a little bit, but it was 1974 when I first got started. I was about 14 years old, fresh out of middle school, and there was a Kenpo school that opened up in our area in National City, California. It was run by Mr. Chicken Gabriel, and I signed up to take lessons there. To be honest with you, I started taking lessons because I had gone through some bullying issues. I was being bullied. I was a very small middle school kid. So I joined basically to learn how to stand up for myself and protect myself. And so that's the start of it. Little did I know that when I joined, it would turn into a lifelong endeavor. I had no idea that I would become a sport karate competitor and end up competing on the national circuit and those kind of things. But that was where it started. And then so I was training there probably about 1976 or so. I became an assistant instructor. I believe I was a blue belt or a green belt, somewhere around there. So around the intermediate area, Chicken kind of trained me to run some classes. Now, I was only a high school student, so it was kind of unusual for him to take a high school student and put him in charge of the whole group. But he was confident that I could do that, and I'll always be grateful to him for that, because it was the start of something unimaginably huge. So I started running some classes there. And then a few years later, that school closed. And so I was kind of an orphan. But what happened, because of my tournament fighting career, there were a few schools in our area that told me, if you'll come to train at our school and train our fighters how to fight in tournaments, then you can train here for free. Now, of course, you're a young high school student. You don't have any money, so you can't pass that up.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I went ahead and did that with a few different schools. And to make a long story short, in the early 80s, there was an instructor. His name was Jack Corbin. He goes by Jack Schomburger now. He has a Kenpo school in New York, but he opened a school and he asked me to be his partner. So I came in and I partnered with Jack, mainly because I needed a place to train. Interesting thing about Jack, he actually was a Taekwondo black belt, but he was in love with the Kenpo school. He loved the Kenpo style. He loved our organization. So he basically merged with us. So when I joined Jack's school, I was in charge of running the Kenpo part. Jack was teaching basically Taekwondo, taught me how to become a better kicker, because he taught me Taekwondo kicks. So we were running that school for maybe a year or so. And then Jack decided he wanted to move back to New York. So he did. So here I am, Reggie. I'm basically all by myself again. Now, the funny thing is, I'm running this school in National City, and the city condemns the block.
Oh,
they actually built a hotel there. So they basically told me everybody here has to move, because we're going to tear down the buildings. So I went to National City, City Council, and I asked them, would they be able to assist me in any way as far as moving from that place? And they did. They gave me a little bit of money, and I was able to move from National City to downtown Chula Vista, and didn't have much money. It was really unlikely that I could open up business, but through the grace of God, I'm telling you, because he just had things align a certain way, and I was able to open a very small school in Chula Vista, downtown Chula Vista. Well, that was in 1985. In 1989, we basically are at the end of our lease and we're busting at the seams. That school is outgrowing the building. So mm-hmm. we move two blocks down the street and we open up another school that's much bigger, which is the school that you came to. You eventually would end up at. Was that school. And so fast forward in about 2013, so I was at that school for 20-something years. In 13, there was some disagreements with management, nothing real major, but we didn't see eye to eye. So I moved across the street to where you're looking at me right now or where you're listening to me mm-hmm. right now. So I'm just across the street from where you used to train. And that's basically what got me here. So like I said, through the grace of God and some pretty unlikely circumstances, we ended up going from that little hole in the wall in National City, and I ended up running this school here in Chula Vista.
Excellent, excellent. So, I mean, was it always kind of the idea to keep, you know, running a school, or did you kind of ever thought like, maybe I might do something else and just kind of do this on the side? Or
yeah, you know, Reggie, that's an excellent question, because when I joined with Jack to be his partner, basically I just wanted a place to train, because again, I didn't have a place, and being his partner there would allow me a place to train, you know, 7 days a week if I wanted to. So that was the main attraction. Really had no intention of running a school. If Jack hadn't moved to New York, I don't think I would have just remained kind of a silent partner in the school, just training there. When he mm-hmm. moved to New York, there was only about 10 students in the school. That was all there was. But I couldn't abandon them, so I kept running the school. And then when the announcement came that they were going to demolish the building, I think my main concern was, what's going to happen to these students? I didn't want to go to them and say, guys, they're tearing down the building, so you're just going to have to find a place to go. So I said, well, let me see what I can do. As far as Chula Vista had always been attractive to me. I always liked the area. So I said, let me just go there. And again, I was just praying about it, just praying if God would be willing to open doors and let something happen. Now, if he didn't, if the business, the landlords here were to say, well, Pete, you don't have the credit or the backing or the history to open a business, then I would look at that as God saying to me, well, this is not what I intend for you to do. So then my plan there was just to maybe find a school and continue training. Never in my wildest dreams did I really plan to be a school opener. I really didn't know much about running a school by myself anyways. Now, here's the funny thing. Earlier in my life, I was taking classes at Southwestern College. As you know, it's a junior college. I was taking accounting classes. My goal was to maybe transfer to San Diego State and become an accountant. I thought that's where my life was headed. Of course, that changed when I opened the school in Chula Vista. But the blessing in all that was my accounting classes actually gave me just enough knowledge to run the business part of the school, to set up the bookkeeping system, kind of gave me a basic idea how to do my taxes, just a few things that just enough to kind of help me start that school. Then from there, it just grew and turned into what it is today. So in answer to your question, was excellent. Yeah, I had no plans to be a martial arts instructor or a business owner.
Yeah, it's funny how the things work out in that way. So
yeah, you're right.
So in your lineage, there's a lot of people, Chicken Gabriel's really known for being a, you know, great tournament competitor and producing a lot of great, great students. So can you maybe talk about just how it was, you know, competing and getting involved with that and kind of being around, you know, other great competitors?
Yes. Yeah. That was really an adventure. So one of the other brown belts, his name was Mike Ocasio. He talked me into entering a tournament. Again, that was something that I didn't really plan to do, but he said, why don't you try? So I tried it. It was funny. We were talking about Master Muhammad, because my first tournament was, and I wrote a little bio about this and it's in there. My first tournament, I was a junior. So I was a teen, not an adult yet. And I fought against a guy named Robert Temple. And he's a direct student under the BKF, Mr. Muhammad lineage. So mm-hmm. he is my first competitor. He beat me pretty badly. But there was a little bit of a rush I got from that. I thought, this is a pretty exciting sport. And again, interesting how life works and how God has his plans, because Robert and I just saw each other last Saturday at the Ed Parker anniversary of Ed Parker's tournament. And he and I have become really good friends. He's a brother in Christ. Whenever we see each other, we pray together and just thank God for that encounter back when we were kids, and the friendship that's grown out of that. So I started to enter more tournaments just here and there, some success and some failure, but I still started to enjoy it. And then you fast forward to, the late 80s. So I become a black belt and I'm competing as a black belt. And I decided to enter some bigger tournaments, start to travel a little bit, go up to the Los Angeles area, even went out east towards Arizona. It was starting to become a lot of fun to do these tournaments. And I got to tell you, Reggie, the real fun was not so much the winning tournaments. I mean, that was happening and that was great. But you kind of touched on it, meeting competitors. Martial arts competition is really different than other sports, because honor and respect and that kind of thing is such a big part of the martial arts. And it kind of spills over into competition. I found out that the best competitors were just the nicest people. And they were really concerned with, I want to see you be successful too. So, I started to share training tips, sometimes even got to train with these guys. And then in the 90s, I decided to fight on the national circuit. It was called the National Black Belt League. Really prestigious league. Some of the best fighters in the world would fight there. Long story short, I started to compete, learned so much, and ended up becoming a nationally ranked competitor. Now, you mentioned some of the great people I trained with out of Chicken Studio. There were some great competitors. Ray Leal was one of my instructors. Foot Sumler was another guy that coached me. But probably the most influential coach was Steve Nasty Anderson. Nasty would go on to become a Hall of Fame tournament competitor. He would compete all over the world. He would train many champions on his own. He became just a side-by-side mentor to me. Funny story, he would, when he lived in San Diego, he ended up in Canada, but when he lived in San Diego, he would call me up at home. It'd be 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night. I'd be in bed and he'd say, Pete, we need to spar. And I'd say, I'm asleep. And he'd say, well, you're going to argue with me for 20 minutes and you're going to end up coming down to the school and spar. Why don't you just jump out of the bed and come on down now? Save yourself a lot of time. Well, he would always be right. I would always end up coming down. So we would train at, ungodly hours of the night. But he would work me. I mean, work me, hard and long. And for some reason, he believed that I could become, great at the sport, even more so than I believed it. He saw something and he said, you can become a world champion. So he would train me. But I tell you what he really did, Reggie, probably even more so than anybody else at our school. Chicken and everybody else had a great part to play. But what Steve did was he instilled this winner's attitude, a champion attitude. He would tell me things like, when you go out to a tournament, the goal is to win. He would say, coming in second is losing. And he said, now I don't mean to be negative, but he said, but if you're going to become a champion, that's the mentality you got to have. You just can't accept anything less than, winning it all. So, I got to be honest with you, Reggie. I would look at him like, well, that's good for you because, you're so good at what you do. I'm just a guy that's trying to get by. I'm just trying to learn and trying to be better. But he was pretty persistent about, no, you can do this. This is, if you're going to work with me, then you're going to train with that attitude. And when we would go to tournaments, he would, he would instill that in me. I'm going to tell you a kind of a funny story. I was a brown belt and he would take me. He would say, Pete, let's walk around. And I'd say, why? And he'd say, just come with me. And he'd walk up and he'd find other brown belt lightweights. I was a lightweight. He would come up to them and he would say things like, you a brown belt? Yeah. You a lightweight? Yeah. And then he would point at me and he'd say, I want you to meet the man who is going to destroy you today. And then he would say to them, there's still time to go to the front and get a refund on your entry fee because you are going to lose to this man. And I'd be looking at these guys like, please excuse my friend here. You know, he's a little bit crazy, you know, but he would do that. And of course, you know, the guys would laugh, I'd laugh. But what I didn't realize was, you know, he was grooming me to think like a champion. Here's the interesting thing about Nasty. If I didn't win, he would never be upset. He would never get mad. He would never put me down. He would just say, you know, this is all part of the journey, but you got to keep thinking this way. You've got to keep thinking like this until you get to the point where you show up at a tournament and people expect you to win. You know, they expect it. He said, if you lose, well, back to the drawing board, get back to work. That's what the sport's about. But he said, but you got to get to the point where everybody that sees you thinks this is the guy to beat. And then you've got to feel like I'm the one to beat. And you know what, Reggie? He kind of set me on that path to becoming a national champion, you know, to the point where now some people have said to me, a lot of people have said to me, you're the most successful sport karate fighter to come out of San Diego since the great Nasty Anderson. It was Nasty. And then when he left, it was you. And going back to what you said, if I trace that back to, you know, the early United Karate Federation days with Chicken and Ray and Foots and Nasty, you know, that kind of set me on that path. And I'll forever be grateful to and be grateful to God for putting me in that position.
That is, yeah, that the mental part of it, you know, just getting in that mindset and getting that point where you know, you can convince yourself to that you're going to believe it. It has so great an effect as far as, you know, propelling you to do, you know, great things, you know.
Yeah.
when you believe it and when you have somebody that can help you, you know, convince yourself that you can do these things, then it really just opens the door for greatness. So that's, I love that.
100% right. 100% right, Reggie. Yeah, maybe the mental part might even be a bigger factor than the physical.
Oh yeah, for sure. So just kind of going through some memories, I definitely have to talk to you about your time training with Wally J, because a story that I still tell often is you were giving a class, going over some of the small circle jiu-jitsu things.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there and was kind of like, this doesn't really sound like it's really going to work. And then I actually got to be a dummy for you while you proceeded to throw me around the floor with one finger. Yeah, you only had one of my fingers, and it was like, okay, get down on the floor. And I got down on the floor and then picked me up and threw me around. And I'm thinking, and the whole time, like, I'm trying to get away from you, and you're just leading me around the studio. And I just couldn't believe what was happening. But, you know, it's like they say, you know, to feel is to believe. And, you know, I became a believer in small circle jiu-jitsu. So,
yeah,
if you could kind of speak on how all of that came about. And,
yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Reggie, for asking about that. That's a great memory. Again, you know, God will lead you down paths. You know, the Bible says many are the plans in a man's heart, but it is the Lord which directs his steps. Well, God directed my steps one day to, again, while I had no place to train, it was one of those times where I didn't really have a place. So I'm kind of wandering around, and God leads me to this jiu-jitsu school. I meet a professor named Professor Denora, and he talks to me about jiu-jitsu. And I said, yeah, I've always kind of found it interesting. So he invites me to a seminar. And in the seminar, Grandmaster Wally J was going to be one of the presenters. So I go to the seminar. I'm practicing in the seminar, and Grandmaster Wally walks in, and you know, everybody bows to him. I had bought two of his books, so I knew who he was, but I met him in person. And the funny thing is, he sits down at a table with all of his books. We're getting ready to take a lunch break, and I walk over to say hello. And the first thing he asked me is, he looks at me and he says, are you from Hawaii? And I said, yes. And then he said, who's your grandfather? And I thought, what a weird thing to ask, you know. But then I realized my grandfather would have been his age. So he's trying to figure out, you know, would I possibly know him from Hawaii, because Grandmaster's from Hawaii. So we talked. It was funny because we immediately struck up a friendship. I ended up going to lunch with him. I ended up driving him to dinner that night. And all the while driving there, singing in front of the old spaghetti factory waiting to get in, he was talking to me about small circle jiu-jitsu. He was telling me stories about how he created it. He was telling me stories about how he taught it to Bruce Lee. That was kind of cool. And so we became, you know, instant friends. And as a matter of fact, Reggie, when you were training at the school, every once in a while, I don't know if you knew this, but the phone would ring. And one of the assistant instructors would pick it up and then come over to me during class and say, you've got a call. And I'd say, can you take a message? And they say, I think you want to take this call because it's Grandmaster Wang Jay. And he would be on the phone and he started to invite me. He'd say whenever he was in California, sometimes it was Sacramento. I remember one time he came to Los Angeles to Dan Inosanto school. Well, he would call me and he'd say, I'm going to be in California. And if you can, I'd like you to come up. So I'd come up to the seminar and I'd continue training with him. A lot of times he's used me as his uke, you know, the one to demonstrate on. And so I started to learn small circle jiu-jitsu again, really never planning to use it. I just found it fascinating. But one day he calls me at the school and he says, hey, Pete, have you started teaching any of the small circle jiu-jitsu? I said, well, no, you know, who am I to teach that? That's your stuff. I'm not stealing it from you. And he says this to me. He says, do you like the techniques? I said, I love them. He said, do you think, and here's the key. He said, do you think they would benefit your students? I said, you know, I think it would. And he says, well, then you should teach it. And so I said, okay. And he says, find a way to incorporate it into your Kenpo. Because he said, you're going to find that it flows into your Kenpo rather nicely. You know, if you search for it, if you, you know, play with it, you kind of experiment and see how it works. And so that's how that I started teaching it at the school, from a phone call from Wally J that said, you know, if you think your students will benefit, and he said, this is the key. If you think they'll benefit from it, then you should show it to them.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about Kenpo is that it's a really good base for combining with other arts, and other arts kind of plug into it so well. Jiu-jitsu, you know, taekwondo. You know, that's kind of one of the other things that I talk to people about is that, oh, well, you know, my instructor, you know, we were more school than normal Kenpo schools were. And it was like, and that's because that, you know, the taekwondo element fits in, which, another one of the stories that I tell a lot is I don't know if it was a thing or just kind of in my head, but kind of had this feeling like the taekwondo schools are kind of taekwondo and Kenpo are kind of rival schools. And I remember there was an instance where some taekwondo folks came to our sparring class and my buddy Wayne, we were kind of like, oh, like we got to get these taekwondo guys. Like they don't think we can keep up with them. And we were just going and, you know, we were keeping up with them. They're, you know, they're throwing the big axe kicks and all this stuff like that. And we're just really keeping up with them. And at one point, Wayne kicks one of the guys and you just hear this loud, just crash. And it's like, I'm like, that didn't sound good. And we could just kind of, you know, shrugged it off. And then after class is over and we're going back to the dressing room, guy is like something's like wrong. And when we're back in the dressing room and he pulls out and his cup is completely shattered.
I remember that.
It's like, oh my goodness. Like this is no joke. But we definitely got to keep up with those guys. But the kind of the other thing that comes up, and I don't know if maybe I'm manifesting it, but in the other conversations that I've had thus far, this has come up in every conversation I've had so far.
Okay.
So back in the day, you know, we were all into the Panther production videos.
I remember Panther.
Yeah, and one of the ones that stuck out to me was one by David German, and he was talking about mixing Kenpo with jiu-jitsu, and there was a particular technique, flashing wings, that he added some wrist locks and some kind of arm bars to it, and that just that just always like really stuck with me. And I just really loved that. And, you know, there would be times where we would just kind of, you know, be off to the side and it's like, oh, well, like, let's try and kind of come up with some own, our own techniques. And okay, you know, if we do, you know, a straight punch, like, okay, we're going to, you know, defend this way and then come around to a wrist lock and, you know, kind of do that. But yeah, yeah, Kenpo is just really, it really connects well with other systems and other methodologies. Yeah.
And, you know, Reggie, over the years, one of the things that I've discovered, more so now than even before, Kenpo is one of the few martial arts where you're encouraged to, you know, modify and personalize. And even Grandmaster Parker used to say the end result, the end game in Kenpo is basically to take it and to make it fit you, kind of make it your own style. You know, and that's kind of the goal. The end goal is to take everything that you learn. And remember, he used to say it's like words in a vocabulary. You know, you learn these words and then you make sentences, then you make paragraphs. Now, he said you don't use every word you learn and you don't use them in the same order all the time. You mix and match in order to get your message across. So he said when you're forming a self-defense technique, you use the different things that you've learned, the different individual techniques, and then you put them together in a way that gets the message across to the attacker, gives you a successful defense. And over the years, I've discovered that's kind of a unique feature of Kenpo, because a lot of the martial arts, you know, you're supposed to do it exactly the way the mm-hmm. teacher does. And mimic him, which I think is great for, it develops great discipline and great self-control, definitely has a benefit. But Kenpo is kind of unique in that respect, where that's not the goal. The goal is not to do it like Grandmaster Parker or me or somebody, but it's to do it like you. I'm starting to discover now, even as a teacher, I'm starting to find these new creative ways to get my students to kind of creatively express themselves based on the techniques that they've learned. And it's pretty fun. And it's pretty exciting to be able to do that.
Excellent. So you also have connections or training with some other notable folks in the Kenpo and martial arts world. And can you?
Yeah, I actually have had a chance to train with, like I said, a lot of the BKF guys, but that was more for sport karate. I did meet Jeff Speakman. And he's actually given me an open invitation to visit his school in Las Vegas the next time I'm out there. I haven't been able to do that yet, but of course, we have got a chance to sit and talk shop, you know, talk a little bit about Kenpo principles, which, as you know, Reggie, just like me and you are doing, when you get a chance to pick these guys' brains, that knowledge can really come in handy, because they'll sometimes say one or two sentences and this light bulb will go off in your head where you're like, oh, yeah. You know, that's a good way to look at this, right? So I've talked to him. I got a chance to talk to George Lim from out in Arizona. He's a well-known Kenpo guy. Now, this is kind of exciting. I was in Nevada, and I was sitting with Shihan Ted Tabura, who has passed away since now. But Shihan Ted, you know him. He's one of the big names in our system. He's a Lima Lama guy, among other things. But he was sitting down. Now, this is a funny story. He's sitting down with an older gentleman. Obviously, they're both from Hawaii because of that accent. So we're talking. I'm just this little boy from Hawaii, and they're just talking to me, and we're just talking back and forth. And all of a sudden, Shihan Ted goes, oh, Pete, I'm sorry. I didn't introduce you to James Ebrow. And I'm kind of shocked. I'm like, oh, my gosh, where's my manner? So I stand up, and I salute him, and I say, I'm sorry, Mr. Ebrow. I didn't know it was you. I know who you are. I've read about you, but I've only seen pictures of you in books. And so I didn't know. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to be disrespectful. He says, never mind, boy, sit down. We're just talking. Never mind that. So we sit down. But going back to what you just said, I got a chance to pick his brain a little bit about how he was instrumental in bringing forms into our Kenpo system. Mm-hmm. In fact, he was one of the major contributors, because you probably know this, when Grandmaster Parker brought Kenpo to the mainland from Hawaii, it didn't have forms. Kenpo was originally just a street self-defense system. It was just meant to work quickly out in the streets. James Ebrow was instrumental in bringing forms in that people could do, because Grandmaster Parker wanted forms to be practiced. He saw some benefit in it. You know, again, I got to meet the guy that was probably the most influential for starting forms in our system. So, and I could go on and talk about a lot of the the older guys that I've met. I trained under General Julian Blue General Lau. We called him Grandmaster Blue. Chief Al Tejero, he's another big Kenpo guy. They were actually friends of Grandmaster Parker. They all lived in Hawaii and they all had trained together at some time. I like to refer to them as his homies. You know, he kind of grew up.
Yeah.
So yeah, they came over here and I got to do some training with both of them. One of the things that they did that influenced me greatly, Reggie, was they kind of started training me on the old Hawaiian techniques. Because when Grandmaster brought Kenpo to the mainland, he modified it a little bit because he said, people here on the mainland don't get to train at the Grandmaster's house for hours and hours. They got jobs, they got families. It's a different lifestyle here than it is on the Hawaiian Islands. So he wanted to design, Grandmaster Parker wanted to design a style that could be trained even if you were by yourself, which is what you have to do a lot, right? You know, you could go through it. So he kind of modified it. Now, what Grandmaster Blue and Chief Al did is they started to train me and say, well, back in Hawaii, this is what your grandmaster used to do. And they started to do a lot more hands-on stuff. You know, you punch me, I'm going to defend and counter. Now I'm going to punch you, you defend and counter. And they said, this was a lot more old school. This is what you would have done if you were back on the islands. You would have been doing this a lot more. I liked it. I was like, this is real meat and potatoes. This is, you know, actually punching and defending and, you know, you got to do it in real time. So, you know, I started to spend more time doing that. I fell in love with not only the practicality of it, but also, you know, the connection to history. Yes. You know, you're doing something that used to be done back in the old school. So after some time and after blessings from those two, I started to teach that more at the school. And I wish you were here more now because I'd love to share it with you. You would have a blast. You'd have a blast doing it. And Reggie, the other thing that came out of that was those two, Grandmaster Blue and Chief Al, they actually ranked me in their systems. They actually promoted me in their systems. They got permission from Chicken and Ray to rank me in their systems. And because I never was, as you know, you were with me many years. I never was concerned about degrees. I never tried to pursue second degree, third degree. In fact, the American Kenpo School would call me and go, what degree are you? We have no idea because you never talk and you never asked to be promoted. And I said, well, I'm just happy doing what I'm doing. So Grandmaster Blue and Chief Al asked Chicken and Ray if they could rank me. And Chicken and Ray said yes. So they started to rank me and I started to move up and then actually became part of the Kaju Kenpo lineage because Grandmaster Blue was a Kaju Kenpo man. So they basically included me in their family tree. So now I'm on the Ed Parker Kenpo tree and I'm on the Kaju Kenpo family tree. So again, you know, what a wonderful blessing.
Yeah, no, that is so great. And I just love that, you know, there's all these great connections to, you know, just, you know, the really, you know, notable folks in the arts. And, you know, there's just always so much to learn. And it's so great to connect with these.
And you know, going back to Chicken for a moment, I've got to thank Chicken for something because early on in my black belt career, he encouraged me to keep learning, you know, and there's a lot of instructors that wouldn't do that, you know, because you might outgrow them, you know, you might start doing things that they didn't do. But Chicken encouraged me. He said, you know, you're like a grown child now. You're an adult child. It's time to, you know, leave the nest and continue to grow. And so I did. And so, like you were saying, meeting all these legends in Kenpo and Kaju Kenpo and receiving their blessings, saying, Pete, I want you to teach what I show you. And then they encouraged me to incorporate it into my teaching. So Chicken sometimes tells people, you know, Pete's doing stuff now that I never even dreamed of doing. He's taken his Kenpo to this whole different level. And I got to thank Chicken for that because, like I said, a lot of instructors, they wouldn't be real happy with people, you know, complimenting one of their black belts and saying, look what your black belt has done. He's taken, he's just, you know, become something really incredible. You know, Chicken, he embraces that. And if it wasn't for him encouraging that in me, you know, that may not have ever happened.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, that's, I love it. So we'll as we get closer to wrapping up, I mean, I could talk to you for days on end, but
me too.
I want to get on record the story that I got to hear when I came to visit about the gentleman that came into the studio and wanted to fight on the
My students called it Freak Monday because it seemed like for a while on several Mondays somebody would walk in the school and challenge me to a fight. Actually, there are several of these that I could tell, but guys would walk in and they would say things like, I want to fight with you. And I would say things like, well, I'm teaching right now. And I'm busy. I'm sorry. I can't do that. And most of the time they'd leave and they'd say, okay, I'll be back. But there was this one guy who kept coming. He kept coming almost weekly and saying, are we going to fight tonight? Are we going to fight tonight? So, finally one night I said, well, I'll be done at 9 o'clock. If you want to come back at 9, we'll fight then. And he, to my surprise, I thought he'd forget about it, but he comes back and he says, I'm ready to fight. So basically he comes in, and now there were several different guys. So I'm going to tell the story about this one guy. He actually comes in and he's getting ready to fight. And then I say to him, wait a minute, you're a black belt too, aren't you? And he says, yeah. Then I said, well, what about the code, the black belt code? He goes, he looks at me and he doesn't want to say, he doesn't know what I'm talking about. So he goes, oh yeah, the black belt. I said, black belt, you know, we're both black belts. We're not allowed to fight each other like this, you know, because we have the code to honor. And then he says, oh yes, that's right, the black belt code. And so he bows to me and then he leaves, you know, and he says, all right. You know, and there were different ways I had of dealing with different people, but long story short, the blessing is I never had to actually fight anybody. You know, I was always able to rely on what hopefully all of us karate guys do. And that's, using our brains and, finding a way to de-escalate and get out of the situation. So I was, I remember one guy came in and he asked to fight. And I told him, I told him we can't because, you know, if one of us dies, you know, the other one gets goes to jail. So, you know, my favorite one when people would come in, and if these guys seemed they were a little bit more lucid and maybe they were really serious about the fighting thing,
mm-hmm.
I would tell them this, and it always worked. I would tell them, I don't do this. I don't do challenge matches. I would say, I'll tell you why, because nobody wins. Because I said, if you beat me, well, I'm going to be very unhappy. And if I beat you, I don't make a friend, I make an enemy. So I say, it's a no-win situation for me. And I don't like to get involved with no-win situations. So I said, so I would tell guys, this is why I don't do this, because very rarely will it end up being a benefit for both you and me. And then he says, well, if you beat me, I'll end up training you. Some people would training with you. And I'd say, well, then why don't you just train with me to begin with? We'll have plenty of opportunities to spar once we're training together, but we don't need to challenge each other to a match to prove that I'm good enough. And some guys would say, well, if you beat me, then I'll train with you because I'll know you're better than me. Then I'll say, I would say to them, well, you're just going to have to trust that I'm a good instructor. And I said, who knows if I'm better than you, but do I have something that's valuable to learn? Maybe. And I said, but the only way we're going to find out is if you take classes. That's the only way both of us win. Yeah. So, you know, again, the martial arts has taught me many things. And, you know, one of them is the art of fighting without fighting, in the words of the great Bruce Lee. Right?
Exactly. I love that. I love the peaceful warrior. It's like, I can do 5 swords on you, but let's talk it out and have a rational conversation about this versus, getting down to the.
You never have to worry about that guy coming back to challenge you because, you know, he's going to remember what you said and say, well, this guy, I got to look for somebody else. This guy's not going to do it.
Exactly. Okay. So to kind of close out here, I got a few little kind of fun questions.
Okay.
So do you have a favorite technique?
You mean out of the traditional Kenpo techniques?
Just, out of any of the Kenpo techniques.
Yeah, you know, that's like asking a father if he has a favorite child.
Exactly.
For my kids, and there's so many really good ones. But, you know, it's funny because two of them kind of pop into my head right off the bat because they use such great Kenpo principles. One of them is seven swords.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one with the seven strikes. The other one is thundering hammers. You know that one.
Yep.
One of the things, the reason those pop into my mind is because seven swords has seven moves, thundering hammers has five moves. But in those few moves, they incorporate so many Kenpo principles, economy of motion, body manipulation. You know, you hit the guy and then judging by the way he reacts, that's where your next hit comes from. And you kind of depend on his reaction to go to the next strike. Knowing that when he reacts, like thundering hammers, when you strike the groin, you know, and he reacts to that, number one, he's not in a position to defend himself or to hit you back because he's busy reacting. And then you go to your next two or three moves, and now he's three moves behind you because you've already struck him three times off of that initial reaction. And now he doesn't even know where the second or third strike came from, because he's busy reacting to the first. So there's so many Kenpo principles in those techniques. So those are two that pop up. But I'm sure if you and I sat around for 10 more minutes,
we'd
come up with about 30 more.
No, for sure. So the next one would be, do you have a favorite form or set?
Yeah. You know what? I would have to go with the tiger and the crane. One, it's a beautiful form. Two, it's very challenging to do because it's long and physically taxing. But I think most of all, I have a sentimental place in my heart for that form because it was the form that launched me into being a forms competitor and a forms champion. I actually was nationally ranked in forms for a while. It's funny because when people see me fighting, they find it hard to believe I even know how to do a form. But I tell them, no, I actually do forms all the time. And it was Tiger and the Crane that actually catapulted me into the national division. And again, and like you and I were saying, Reggie, the blessing was I got to meet some of the top forms competitors in the world, you know, competing in forms and you know, got to learn from them. There's a guy named Rod Allo. Mm-hmm. He was one of the top forms competitors of his day. Still can do an amazing form. He still can. And he became one of my closest friends. And we were actually very close friends during competition. And there's nothing quite like competing with one of your best friends and, you know, using that friendship to propel each other and to motivate each other to just be at your very best. And again, you know, I owe him so much because he really pushed me because he was so good and such a knowledgeable guy about the history of his art. And he really kind of encouraged me, know the history of your art. It'll make you a better forms competitor.
Excellent.
So Tiger and the Crane would have to be at the top of the list. Chinese book set would run a very, very close second.
Those are my two. So that was so, you know, when I started at the school that I'm at now. So for going back a little bit, for the longest time, I didn't realize that there were different versions of Kenpo. And when I started at the school that I'm at now, it was like, oh, well, you know, I admit I was for a moment, I was a little disappointed that I had to start over again, but you know, it's okay. I mean, it's quite a bit different, my training now than when I trained with you, but I was all excited. I was like, oh, like, I can't wait till I get to do book set and Tiger and Crane. And it's like, we don't do those. It was like, what?
Oh, that's really,
I couldn't wait to that. So, but
Reggie, those are two of the Kung Fu based forms.
Yeah.
They weren't born out of our system. They were born out of the Kung Fu system. So, So some schools don't do them.
So I was just like, oh, those are the ones I want to do, but I've got your videos. I've got your videos and I've been working on them. Well, book set at a Mass Attack anyway.
Okay.
Good. I'm going to have to find a way to get out to you so I can learn Tiger and Crane.
But, we'll have to do that.
But yeah, those are my favorites. So.
Yeah.
And then our last one, if there's anyone that you could train with, whether it be living or non-living, fictional or non-fictional, who would you wish that you could train with?
Well, you know, first of all, I've got the chance to train with so many legends that it's I'm blessed in that respect. And, you know, it's hard to say that, oh, I wish I had more because I've been blessed with so much. But of course, the obvious answer would be Bruce Lee. You know, if he was around, and I sometimes think because I've gone to Dan Inosanto's school several times and trained with him, and he's amazing, by the way. But, you know, since he was directly connected to Bruce, right, I sometimes think, gee, you know, what if Bruce was still alive and I went up to the school and then Dan had that connection and he said, well, let's take a class with Bruce. You know, I think for all of us martial artists, right, that would maybe be the ultimate, not only because of who he was and what he accomplished and what he did with his martial arts, but even the way his mind worked, you know. Mm-hmm. But now we all say that he was a martial artist way ahead of his time.
Oh, his for sure.
Was, yeah, way ahead of what other people were ready for. And, you know, almost every MMA guy that we know says that he's the real father of MMA.
Yeah.
Because, you know, of what he did. So I think, you know, how could we pass up that chance if we were ever given that? So
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for sitting down and chit-chatting with me.
Reggie, thank you. I appreciate you thinking of me to do this. It was really,
of course.
Really appreciate you
were one of the, you were probably the first person I thought of when I finally
thank
decided
so
I was going to do this. So, yeah, we could definitely do this for many, many moons.
Love talking about martial arts.
Oh yeah, for sure. So, you know, we'll definitely have to do this again, but thank you so much for your time, and we will talk again real soon.
Yes, God bless you, Reggie, and God bless your training. I'm so happy to see you doing it again.
All right. Yeah, thank you.